We're very happy to have Akash Dixit today as our seminar speaker. Akash is finishing his PhD at University of Chicago, where they recently achieved tremendous, incredible results in single photon detection. And he's gonna tell us about their techniques and how they use it to detect dark matter. So please take it away.
Awesome, thank you very much. Okay, hey everybody, my name is Akash, and I'll tell you a little bit about our work using superconducting qubits to search for dark matter. I just wanted to give a shout out to all my collaborators, Vatsan, Kevin, Ravi, and Ankur, who's here with us, and my advisors, Aaron and David. Okay. So a quick outline of what I'll be telling you about today. First, I'll describe sort of the way we think about coupling to low mass bosonic dark matter and why that's interesting and why we care about dark matter maybe. And then I'll tell you our efforts to construct a single photon counter to detect this dark matter. Of course, once you build a new detector, you're always gonna have some sort of errors associated with that detection process. And so I'll tell you about the way we devised a method to overcome these detectors or these errors. Then I'll tell you about how we go about characterizing the photon counter. And finally, I'll describe how we can then use this detector to perform a dark matter search. And I'll tell you some of my ideas about the prospects of using this sort of detector in future dark matter searches as well. Okay, so everyone probably knows all of this stuff, but the influence of dark matter on our universe is evident in all sorts of phenomena, such as the rotation curves of stars and spiral galaxies, you know, lensing behavior in the CMB, and the basic structure of the matter in our universe. But we still haven't been able to directly detect the dark matter or study its intrinsic nature in terrestrial experiments so far. Today, I'll discuss a specific class of dark matter candidates, the low mass bosonic candidates, and how we might detect those candidates. As an example, I've listed two potential candidates, the axion and the hidden photon. And the idea here is that the detection mechanism would be these dark matter candidates convert into a microwave photon that we can then detect. In the case of the axion, this needs to be in the presence of a magnetic field in order to enable this, this process. And in the hidden photon case, it spontaneously could occur where the hidden photon converts to a microwave photon. The conventional strategies for trying to detect these microwave photons is to capture the signal in a resonant microwave cavity and then use a linear quantum limited amplifier to measure that signal. One of the challenges to this technique is that as we search for higher mass axions or hidden photons or dark matter candidates, the frequency, the resonant frequency of this cavity will also have to increase to maintain that resonant condition between the two. As you increase the frequency of the cavity, the effective volume of your cavity starts to shrink and it scales pretty poorly with frequency. So as you go to higher mass searches, the volume of your detector starts to shrink and your signal therefore also starts to shrink. While at the same time, your quantum limited amplifier, due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, will always inject effectively one photon's worth of background in your search. And this situation is pretty hard to overcome, where your signal probability is sub one photon and your background is one photon, and this becomes untenable really quickly. So let me tell you a little bit about how I think about tackling this issue.
Akash?
Yes, go ahead.
No, just the dummy question is why microwave photon? Any reason?
Yeah, so that's sort of where we think these axions and hidden photons, where their masses are in the few hundreds of megahertz, maybe a few gigahertz at the moment, but the space is wide open and we don't really have too many constraints on where we think these could be. This just happens to be where people are looking for various reasons at the moment.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about what the basic structure of one of these experiments looks like in my mind. Well, you need to have the microwave cavity, which accumulates the signal that's produced by the dark matter. In the case of the axion, this lives inside of a large magnetic field. And then you need to be able to transport that signal to a location where you want to detect it. And so this is the link to our work on how we try to detect these photons. So what I'll tell you about is whatever's in this purple box. And we are working on some things here in this red box. And I think the part in the green box is very challenging, but I'd love to have many discussions about this, maybe after the talk. Okay, so let me tell you about this purple box. So the traditional conventional technique for detecting small signals inside of a microwave cavity is to use a very low noise, quantum limited, in fact, linear amplifier. The effect of this is essentially to measure the phase space of the field to a very high accuracy. But of course, there's some irreducible amount of phase space that is associated with this measurement. And that just comes from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And that's sort of represented by this blob here. And as you can see, you have imperfect information about both quadratures. In this case, I'm representing them as position and momentum. But once you start to look for signals that are much smaller than this blob, this sort of search becomes extremely untenable. And so the way we've thought about doing this is to squeeze this phase space such that it now looks like a ring, essentially. A ring that is incredibly thin, but spans around the entire space here in a big circle. And the idea here is that you have no information, completely randomized information about the phase of the field you're trying to detect, but you have very accurate information about the amplitude of the field. And in effect, this means you're counting the number of photons inside of your cavity by measuring the amplitude. And this is exactly the right type of question we need to be asking to do a dark matter search at this moment, right? All we care about is if the dark matter deposited a photon in the cavity. At the present, it doesn't matter what the phase of that field happens to be. And so we're completely okay giving up that piece of information. So I advocate that this is the exact type of experiment that we should be doing. And this is the type of detector we should be attempting to build for our dark matter experiments.
And just to be clear, so this is the main source of noise of your detector, right?
Once you get down to a quantum limited detector amplifier, that's right.
But you're not there yet? So
they're close. We're like maybe two times the quantum limit, but there are detectors out there that are already at the quantum limit.
And what's the other, what are the other sources of noise?
Well, you can have actual background photons that just enter your cavity directly. I'll tell you a little bit about that. And that ends up being our main source of noise in this experiment.
I see. Okay, so first you need to beat that, and then the squeezing will become relevant.
Well, first you need to beat the quantum noise of your amplifier. And then if there are residual photons in your cavity, that'll then become your limiting noise source.
I see.
We aren't there with these conventional detectors, but what I'll describe maybe a little bit later in this talk is that once we move to this squeeze detection method, the backgrounds actually become the dominant source.
I see. Great, thank you.
Sure. Okay, so how do we actually go about building one of these photon counters? So this is actually a picture of me holding one of the qubits that I built, which I thought was a really cool picture. So I just wanted to share it. And it gives you a sort of sense of scale of how big these detectors and these systems actually are. Okay, here's a little schematic of our detector. And there's three main components here. The first is a storage cavity. By the way, can everybody see my mouse moving around? Okay, cool. So there's a storage cavity, and this is where the photon that's produced by the dark matter is stored. And then there's a qubit that lives on a sapphire chip here that's coupled to the storage cavity that we're going to use to measure the photon inside of the storage cavity. And finally, there's this auxiliary cavity that I call the readout cavity, and its purpose is to measure the state of the qubit. So these cavities are made out of high purity aluminum. The qubit is made out of aluminum and a Josephson junction of aluminum oxide, and it lives on a sapphire substrate. And all of this is operated inside of an 8 millikelvin dilution refrigerator for two reasons. One is you need the superconducting materials to go superconducting, so you need to take them to low temperatures, but also you want to suppress thermal photons as much as possible. And that means going to as low temperatures as possible. The interaction I've written here describes the Hamiltonian of the qubit and one of these cavities. So the first two pieces are probably familiar to everybody. The first is the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator. So that's the cavity, A dagger A. We can describe the qubit as a spin with two states, you know, a ground state and an excited state and some transition frequency between them. And the interaction term between the two systems has an energy scale that I'm calling 2 chi here and has the form A dagger A times sigma z. And I'll tell you a little bit about why that is important and how we can take advantage of that. So quickly, let me describe how you actually make one of these qubits. The idea here is you start with an LC oscillator and that's just a harmonic oscillator and it should have a quadratic potential. And what you do is you replace the inductor part of that LC oscillator with a nonlinear inductor. And that nonlinearity comes from one of these Josephson junctions, of which I've taken a picture in the SEM here. And when you do this, your potential is no longer quadratic, but it ends up being periodic. And the effect of this, the consequence of this, is that the levels inside of your potential are no longer equally spaced, like in a harmonic oscillator. And so you can uniquely address the ground to excited state transition without accidentally populating higher levels. And this is what makes it a qubit. And this is also what allows us to write the Hamiltonian of this as just a sigma z between these two states, the ground and excited state. And the really cool thing about these superconducting qubits is that we make them in the lab. So they're completely customizable and can be engineered to be whatever we want them to be. So we can design the transition frequency to be what we want it to be. And by attaching some antennas to it, we can design the dipole moment of this device as well. And so we can control the coupling between the qubit and the cavity we want to couple to. So let me just quickly describe that process. The way I think about the coupling between the qubit and the cavity is really just a dipole living inside of an electric field. And the interaction just goes like D dot E. So writing that in terms of constituent operators, you get something that has sigma pluses, minuses, and A and A dagger. In the limit where we operate, where the coupling between the qubit and the cavity is small compared to the detuning between their transition frequencies, you can approximate this Hamiltonian as such. In the case where your qubit is actually a real two-level system, this chi is something like G squared over delta. But of course, our qubits aren't really two-level systems. There are multiple levels, but we only use the first two levels. The chi has a slightly different form, and it also has some dependence on the anharmonicity of the qubit, which we can discuss if you're interested in that. But this is how it goes. Okay, so the cool thing about this is we can completely design this chi to be whatever we want it to be, and that'll become handy in this next slide. So here I've conveniently written the Hamiltonian in this suggestive fashion where I've grouped the interaction term with the qubit term. And what this shows us is that the cavity occupation is now imprinted into the qubit frequency. So that's what you see here. Everything before sigma z tells you what the qubit frequency is. And you can see that there's a dependence on A dagger A, the number of photons inside of the cavity. And that's what I'm showing here with this data as well, where I take a spectra of the qubit, and I can see that its transition frequency has multiple peaks here associated with there being 0, 1, or 2 photons in the cavity. And these peaks are spaced by this energy scale 2 chi that we've engineered. So now this gives us a clear picture that we can use this frequency separation to make a measurement of the number of photons in the cavity. And that's exactly what we do. We use a Ramsey interferometry measurement to measure the qubit frequency and therefore infer the number of photons in the cavity. So let me walk you through what one of those measurements ends up looking like. So let's take two situations. One where there are no photons in the cavity, and one when there is one photon in the cavity. The block sphere here represents the state of the qubit during this measurement process. So let's start out in the, let's start out in the ground state for both of these cases. The first thing we do is we pulse the qubit to put it into its clock state. So we push it into the horizontal plane of the block sphere. Now, since the transition frequency of the qubit between this case and this case is different by 2 chi, in this case, the qubit rotates or precesses around the block sphere at a rate of 2 chi faster than in the n equals zero case. And that's what I've depicted here, where the qubit is precessing around the block sphere. So if you time this exactly right, you can catch the qubit when it's traveled all the way around the block sphere or accumulated a phase of pi. And when this happens, you apply a final pi over two pulse and you project the qubit state back onto the z-axis. And when you do this, you see exactly the result that we want. When there are zero photons in the cavity, the qubit returns back to its original state. But when there's one photon in the cavity, the qubit state is flipped. So we've developed a protocol that changes the qubit state depending on the number of photons in the cavity. And that's exactly what we need to use to measure the number of photons in the cavity. Okay.
Can I ask a dumb question? I thought you were going to, so this, the frequency splittings here were fractions of a gigahertz. I thought you were going to talk about gigahertz detection in the end, or?
Yeah, so the photon is at a few gigahertz.
Oh, I see.
So we're detecting the presence of a gigahertz photon in the cavity using a few megahertz splitting of the qubit.
I see.
So here's a quick experiment that I did when I first started to get this process to work. These first 50 experiments, I prepare the cavity with zero photons. And in the next 50, I prepare the cavity with one photon in there. And then I apply this Ramsey interferometry measurement to it. And when there's zero photons, I mostly measure zero. And when there's one, I mostly measure one. But the interesting stuff is that when there are zero photons, sometimes I measure one. And when there is one photon, sometimes I measure zero. And these are your false negatives and your false positives. And we understand why these are happening. These are basically because your qubit is spuriously excited sometimes. And that sort of sets these errors. And these are optimally bad for our type of experiment, because what this looks like is a dark matter event where the dark matter deposited a photon, successfully flipped the qubit. So our goal is to try to mitigate these false positives as much as possible. So let me tell you a little bit about how we go about doing that. And the way to see this is to go back again and look at the interaction Hamiltonian between the qubit and the cavity. And notice, maybe people already noticed this and I didn't say it, but the interaction is really just a product of the number operators, A dagger, and sigma z, which are here in the first two terms of the Hamiltonian. And what that means is obviously this part commutes with the rest of the Hamiltonian. And so when you use this interaction term to measure the state of the cavity, you're not absorbing or destroying the photon, you're just projecting the cavity back into its eigenstate of A dagger A here. And what that means is you can use this interaction to make multiple measurements of the same photon. And we call that a quantum non-demolition interaction. And we'll take advantage of this fact to suppress errors in our qubit measurement. And here's a pulse sequence of how we go about doing this. So there's some pulse on the cavity, whether this is injected by us or the dark matter. And then there's a series of these Ramsey interferometry measurements, which are also known as parity measurements. And we use these to make multiple measurements of the same photon that's inside of the cavity. Once you apply this sequence, what you're gonna get is a series of measurements. And our goal is to then take these series of measurements and try to decide what is the probability that there was a photon or there wasn't a photon in the cavity when we started making these measurements. And the way to do that is to apply this hidden Markov model to your cavity qubit readout system. For us, the qubit and the cavity states are hidden from us, and all we have access to is some readout of the state of the qubit at the end of each measurement. But we understand how the qubit and the cavity transition between states between each measurement, and that's encapsulated in this matrix T. And that includes information about the qubit and the cavity lifetimes, the spurious population of the qubit, the dephasing, and each of the timescales of these experiments. And then, of course, when we make a measurement of the qubit to obtain one of these readouts, that readout is imperfect, and that's captured here in this emission matrix. And the probability of correctly measuring the state of the qubit is something like 95%. So once you have all this, so I'll just say that all of these quantities are independently measured in separate experiments, and we can, you know, construct this transition in this emission matrix independently. And then we obtain the series of readouts from our measurement. So then how do you go about reconstructing the state of the cavity? Well, there's just an equation that you can use to do this, and it involves, you know, all the measurements are 0, 1 to n, and all of the different transition and emission elements associated with those readouts. This is a bit opaque, hard to kind of understand just by looking at it. So let's maybe go through one example of a potential readout sequence that you would get and what all of the different terms you would need to include in this reconstruction are. So say you measure the qubit to be in the ground state, and then you measure it to be in the excited state in your next measurement. So what are all the possible ways this could happen? Well, the first is the best case scenario, where there is a photon in the cavity. The qubit successfully flips in response to there being a photon in the cavity, and you correctly measure that the qubit has flipped from the ground to the excited state. So that's great, that's one way. The other way is that there is no photon in the cavity, but your qubit spuriously flips, and then you correctly measure that the qubit has flipped. And in the final case, there's no photon, the qubit does not flip, but you make an imperfect measurement of the qubit and you think it has flipped into the excited state. So all of these sort of terms are encapsulated in this reconstruction. And so this is just a hint at the way we do this. But I'm not actually sitting there enumerating all these possibilities. The equation takes care of that for us.
Sorry, but what, isn't it this just like measuring n times and the error goes as 1/√(n) or something?
That's essentially what's happening. There's nothing quantum mechanical about this process. It's enabled by the fact that our interaction is quantum non-demolition, but the process of measuring the same system many times is classical. The first measurement is the only quantum mechanical process here, where you're projecting the state of the qubit using the interaction.
But I guess that, I mean, what I'm trying to understand is, why do you need to do this? Why don't you just like do your measurement 10 times and then the error should go as 1/√(n) and that's it?
Yeah, that's what I'm about to tell you.
Okay, sorry for that.
Right, so the idea is that I'm making multiple measurements of the same photon using the qubit, and the error in any, the possibility that a series of qubit errors could look like a false positive is exponential in the number of measurements I make, right? That's sort of the end goal of this. So let me walk you through that process here. So in the first example, let's take a situation where there are no photons in the cavity. And you see, as a function of the number of measurements we make, the state of the qubit is just in the ground state in each measurement. When we apply this reconstruction with very high confidence, we can say that there are no photons in the cavity. So this is good. This is what is expected. But let's take the other case, where you see the qubit flipping back and forth between the ground and excited state in each of your measurements. Then when you apply this reconstruction, with very high probability, you see that there is one photon in the cavity. And most importantly, the probability that there were 0 photons in the cavity, but a series of qubit errors produced this result of measurements, is exponentially small. So you can see that this y-axis is in log scale. So the key here is that you get an exponential suppression of detector-based false positives, but only with a linear increase in the number of measurements you make. So there's nothing quantum mechanical about this. It's a very classical thing, but this is exactly the type of measurement we want to be making, where we give up a little bit in the measurement time, but we get an exponential suppression in the false positives. And this is sort of the key to this process. And it's all enabled by the fact that your interaction between the qubit and the cavity is quantum non-demolition. And you can make multiple measurements of the same photon.
Yeah, can I ask? So this property of being non-demolitional, is it stable? So, I mean, if there is the interaction is a bit different, won't you get accumulated error from there?
So you're right that it's not 100% quantum non-demolition. There is some probability that you will project the state of the cavity to something other than what you expect it to be. But that error scales as something like G over delta squared. And so that number is very small. So our quantum non-demolition probability is something like 99%+. So if you make 100 or 1,000 measurements, you might get one in which you accidentally project the state of the cavity to something other than what you expect it to be. Mm-hmm. So on the scale of tens of measurements, it doesn't really make a big deal for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of how I think about that. And of course, if you wanted to be able to make 1,000 measurements or 10,000 measurements, you would just make the G over delta smaller, and you could make this interaction more Q and D. So the interaction term is an approximation, of course, and the small parameter that we're using to make that approximation is G over delta. The smaller you make that, the better your Q and D approximation is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then I probably don't get where are the false positives were coming from? I mean, what are the fluctuations that give that?
So if you just made one of these measurements, say this measurement right here, and you didn't have a bunch of measurements before and after it, and you just saw this,
mm-hmm.
there's actually an error that occurs here in the eighth measurement, where your qubit accidentally flips, even though there wasn't, well, in this case, your qubit doesn't flip even though there was a photon, but you could get a situation where your qubit flips even though there is no photon. And so you need to have these series of other measurements here such that one of these errors is inconsequential amongst a series of these.
Yeah, and it flips because of what? Because of some extra noise, interaction with environment, or because the interaction with the pulse is not ideal?
So this is sort of an open question in the quantum information field, but there's two ideas. One is that it's just stray photons that are at the frequency of the gap of the aluminum that we use to make the superconducting qubit. And you have quasi-particles that are generated, and when these tunnel across the junction, you get one of these flips. The other idea is that you can get gamma radiation or other sorts of radiation that hit the substrate that your qubit lives on, which then produces phonons, which then couple to the quasi-particles and again produce this flipping process. But it's still a little bit of an open question, and people are figuring out how to suppress these sorts of events.
Sorry, but that I don't understand. So if it's an actual background event, like say some phonon or something, then the flip is real. So then the square root of n shouldn't get rid of that.
Why would you say that it wouldn't get rid of that, I guess?
Because say that you have a whatever dark matter that creates a photon, and then the photon honestly creates this spin flip. Because you count the photon, so that you honestly have a photon. If you have a background event is also an honest photon, right?
A background photon is a photon, but a background that produces a flip in the qubit is not a photon.
So because that flip wouldn't stay there? Or
what? Well, because there isn't a photon in the cavity, right? It's just a flip of the qubit because the qubit is coupled to phonons and quasi-particles, right? So that flip of the qubit is not measuring the photon in the cavity, it's measuring some other bath, like quasi-particles.
And that's somehow distinguishable than a measurement of a single photon because...
Well, your single photon lives for a few hundreds of microseconds, and so you can make multiple measurements of it with your qubit.
Right.
But a flip of your qubit due to quasi-particles or radiation only occurs once.
I see. And how long does this like 30 measurements or like 1,000 measurements take?
So each of these measurements, I constructed it to take about 10 microseconds. So the 30 measurements takes 300 microseconds.
I see.
And the T1 of the cavity, or the lifetime of the photon, is about 500 microseconds, 550 microseconds. But yeah, I'll tell you a little bit later about how we can get that number down to 1 microsecond. And so this will take only 30 microseconds instead of 300. But some progress we've actually made actually this week, which was really cool to see. Okay, so let me tell you about how we can actually characterize this detector. And the way we do that is just by injecting a calibrated source of photons into our cavity. And that's sort of what I've shown here. So on the horizontal axis is the mean photon population that we inject into the cavity. And on the vertical axis is the measured photon population, using the repeated parity measurements and reconstructing the state of the cavity and applying a threshold to that reconstruction to then determine if there's a photon. And this is sort of what the threshold is there. There's two important features to this measurement. One is up here at higher injected photon numbers. And there you can see that with something like a 40% deficiency, we measure the photons that we inject. The other part here that's interesting is when we inject essentially no photons in the cavity, you still measure a number of these events here. And these are our false positives. And so the question is, well, what are these false positives? And the way to think about that is, well, let's look at a histogram of these events where I histogram the log likelihood ratio of one of these events for when I inject a significant number of photons versus when I inject very, very few photons. And you can see that when I inject a lot of photons, I measure a lot of events that have a high likelihood ratio of being a photon. And subsequently, when I inject no photons, there are a few, but a non-zero number of events where I measure the likelihood of this event being a real photon and not a series of qubit errors to be something like 7.3 times 10 minus 4 probability. And so this tells us that we're rejecting the detector errors, but we've now entered this regime where we're limited by real background photons that are inside of our cavity, right? And the population is, again, this 7.3 times 10 to the minus 4 in the cavity. So a way to connect this to the dark matter is quite simple here. For a dark matter experiment, you want your signal photon count to be, well, greater by some factor than the deviations of your background photon count, right? And so what this means is that the integration time for a dark matter experiment scales with the rate of your background. And what we've shown here, well, maybe I forgot to say this, but what we've shown here is that this false positive probability that we have here is already something like 1,000 times better than what you would get if you were just using a linear quantum limited amplifier, which is equivalent to having about one photon's worth of noise. And this corresponds to a 16 dB advantage. So you can already see that by reducing this background probability by a factor of 1,000 means that your integration time for a dark matter experiment already increases by a factor of 1,000, which is a huge win, especially when you're, you know, you're starved for this very, very small signal. Okay, so we already maybe talked about this a little bit, but what are the sources of these backgrounds and what are some mitigation strategies that we're already employing and people are already thinking about? The most obvious one is, well, your lines are leaky and all the components in your fridge aren't thermalized well. And so all that tells us to do is to add more attenuation, add more filtering on our lines, and make sure we thermalize all of the components inside of our dilution refrigerator as well as we possibly can to beat down any of these stray photons coming down our lines. So this is something we've already started thinking about. The other possible channel in which you can get background photons in your cavity is actually through the qubit. And this is actually pretty simple to see. The qubit and the cavity are essentially two coupled systems, and a little bit of the qubit participates in the cavity. And so what that means is if you get a spurious excitation of the qubit, there's a very, very small chance, but still a non-zero chance that excitation will be converted into a photon in the cavity. And so not only do we have to shield the cavity from directly having background photons, we need to shield the qubit from having spurious excitations as well. And some of the sources of that have been measured. They're radiation, as well as high frequency photons. And so people are already thinking about how to protect your qubit from having these sorts of events occur. And some other, some other idea. Sorry, go ahead.
This means that what you have in mind is that like a track passes through the substrate of the qubit or something, it creates a photon that makes it into the cavity?
No, it's the if there's a track that passes through the substrate that produces phonons in here, the phonons then couple to the quasi particles in the qubit, essentially the electrons in the qubit. The electron tunnels across the Josephson junction and produces a flip of the state of the qubit. But that flip of the state of the qubit is actually not just a flip of the state of the qubit. It's a flip of the state of the qubit plus a small probability of the flip of the state of the cavity, right? Because the qubit and the cavity are coupled with some small mixing angle.
I see.
And so you can directly convert the radiation that impacts your substrate into a photon in the cavity because you have this qubit coupled to the cavity.
And what happens with the radiation that you create in the substrate itself? Like when the track passes, doesn't that make it into the cavity? So in particular, your substrate is sapphire, which is polar, and it has lattice resonance modes, exactly. Okay. at the milli EV energy range. Therefore, any track that passes through there may generate, because you have a resonant lattice, which okay. Then the polar modes of the sapphire will couple strongly to ANM. Therefore, any track that passes through that will generate like milli EV photons.
I see.
We chose sapphire.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah, so this is great. So this is kind of why I have this slide here. I don't think this is 100% understood. So it's totally possible that you could have these events where the polarization of the materials in the sapphire actually then radiates right into the cavity. So you're saying milli EV, right? So that might be a little bit too high of an energy. The energy of these photons is closer to a few micro EV.
Right. But
maybe there's a mismatch there, but it's still possible that you could, maybe those are, well.
Yeah, I'm just not sure if like a photon with that energy, I mean, the substrate is probably like kind of, you will need to hit the lattice mode, then the photon, the sapphire will need to be somehow transparent, because I guess the only hole that there's into the cavity is just the substrate itself or the qubit itself, right? So mm-hmm. The photon needs to make it into the cavity somehow.
That's right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, so the phonons could be bouncing around anywhere in the substrate. And so even if the radiation strike happens here, the phonon could be over here, and that could produce radiation that's in the region where the sapphire is actually poking into the cavity, right? So that seems reasonable that could happen.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's a great point. I think that's something that people could think about. I'm not sure how that would work, but that's a great idea. Some other ideas that people have been thinking about in terms of modifying the qubit itself so that it doesn't have these spurious excitations is, well, you could just engineer the gap of the material you use. You could put traps inside of the superconductor here to absorb any of the quasi particles before they can tunnel across the junction. And you can just start using higher band gap materials to suppress the probability that a phonon will produce a quasi particle. So people have already started making qubits using tantalum. You could use niobium or titanium nitride and maybe even other materials. And as was mentioned just now, maybe there's two-level systems or other sort of impurities or polarizations of the material in the sapphire itself that might be able to directly produce the radiation. That's a very interesting idea. And here's some references to all of these sorts of ideas and the work that people are doing in relation to them. I kind of want to just give what the prospects of this qubit type measurement are in terms of just doing metrology. So already we can see that this qubit based counting can achieve sub SQL metrology, and you get something like a 16 dB advantage relative to the quantum limit. And it compares really well with all of the other types of systems that are already working on this type of metrology, like ions or condensates or atoms. In this case, they have a lot of these systems. We only have one qubit, but we're able to make 30 measurements. So you can kind of compare these two things. And I think this, in principle, doesn't really have a limit as long as you can work really hard, like we said on the previous slide, to eliminate all these sources of qubit excitations and cavity excitations. And we've already showed that we can get the probability of the qubit excitations down by a factor of 10 or 100 already in this device, actually. And so we can achieve something like, instead of 16 dB of metrological advantage, we can already achieve something like 25 dB of advantage. And I think by working a little bit harder and some more innovative techniques, this can get down even further. And the important point to make here is that 25 dB of advantage corresponds to a 100,000 times improvement in your integration time for a dark matter experiment. And that's sort of the key thing to remember with this protocol. You want to get this improvement in your dark matter experiment. Okay. Some other ideas that we've had to further improve the protocol are listed here. The first is we want to use a parametric amplifier to do the readout of the qubit state. This not only would increase the readout fidelity, it would reduce the number of photons that we have to use to probe the state of the qubit, and therefore also reduce the time per readout. And we've recently been able to demonstrate resetting the readout cavity so we don't have to wait between measurements very long. So in this particular experiment, I had to wait 10 microseconds between each measurement before I made sure everything was back in its equilibrium state before I tried the next measurement. But we recently found that we could wait less than a microsecond potentially between each measurement. So that significantly speeds up the experiment time and increases the rep rate. Additionally, one thing that you may have noticed is that the probability of errors of your qubit are asymmetrical between when you start in the excited state versus when you start in the ground state. This is not surprising. The probability of decaying from the excited state is something like 9% in this 10 microseconds, but the probability of heating of the qubit is much smaller. So it's beneficial to always start in the ground state. And so one of the things that we've worked on is being able to reset the state of the qubit after a measurement from its excited state back to its ground state. And this works pretty well. So this is another way in which we can improve this protocol. And of course, I'm very happy to discuss even more ideas that people might have about how we can improve this. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about how we can then apply this detector to perform a dark matter search and what some of my ideas are of how this will work going forward. The first thing to note is that the detection protocol is slightly different than the conventional dark matter search. And the reason is you're making these repeated measurements of the state of the cavity. Effectively, you're xenosuppressing the evolution of the cavity. So you have to have this distinct region where you integrate the dark matter signal and this distinct region where you measure the state of the cavity. And these two things can't overlap with each other. And so you have this separation where you integrate for something like 500 microseconds, and then you measure in this case for something like 300 microseconds, and then you repeat this whole procedure again. So we did something like 15,000 of these experiments, and that took a total of 13 seconds, of which 8 seconds were integration. So this corresponds to the 65% 2D cycle that's set by how long each one of these measurements takes. And like I said, we were able to get this down to a microsecond recently. And so this duty cycle jumps from 65% to 90%+, which is already really exciting. So in this experiment, we counted something like 9 photons. And the question we want to ask then is, if we believe that these are all background photons and not the dark matter, what hidden photon mixing parameter would be excluded by this observation? And there's a few things that we have to take into account, which is what are all the possible signals our qubit detector is sensitive to. So one thing that to note is that although the procedure for measuring the state of the cavity using the qubit is tuned for excitations that are on resonance with the cavity, we do have some non-zero probability of being able to measure off-resonance signals as well. The efficiency of the detection goes down, as you can see, pretty quickly, but there's a region where you can still measure photons that are off-resonant from your cavity as well. The other thing that I haven't really mentioned before is that the Ramsey interferometry measurement that we perform to measure the state of the cavity not only can discriminate between zero or one photons, but it can distinguish between an even number of photons and an odd number of photons. And that has to do with the fact that when your qubit is rotating around the Bloch sphere, rotating 2 pi is the same thing as rotating 4 pi, or equivalently the rotating of pi is equivalent to 3 pi. And so what that means is that any large amplitude signal that has a photon population greater than one, as long as it has odd numbers of photons in that population, we are sensitive to that. Of course, all of these sensitivities are not unlimited. The limitations are mostly set by the bandwidth of the pulses that we use to operate the qubit itself. Okay, so putting all of that together, here's sort of what the exclusion of the dark matter would look like. Of course, we're not doing an axion search here because we have no magnetic field, but we can put some sort of constraints on a hidden photon candidate. So on the vertical axis is the mixing parameter between hidden photons and microwave photons. And on the horizontal axis is the mass of the dark matter, or equivalently the frequency of the photon that it produces. I mean, you can see that this experiment is already extremely sensitive, very close to the resonance of the cavity. And then when you zoom into this, you can see the structure that's associated with the fact that we can see slightly off resonant photons, as well as some large amplitude photons. And the cutoffs of these things are set by the bandwidths of the pi over two pulses. And so this is already very interesting. And this is an experiment that took, 8 seconds to conduct, essentially 8 seconds of integration time. And you can see that we're already as low as the best hidden photon experiments can do. Obviously, this is an attuned experiment at the moment, but I think in the next slide, let me show you a little bit about how we can potentially make this compatible with one. Does anyone have any questions about this? Maybe I should pause here for a quick second.
I have one naive question. So the qubit, it's like you have your substrate, and the qubit is on one side of the substrate or something, right?
That's right.
So why don't you just put another one in the other side of the substrate to mitigate backgrounds? Because any background, so if you have a qubit, so anything, any track that passes will probably mess up the two qubits, one of the and the other side of the substrate and the one on the side of the substrate that is going to the cavity, right?
Yeah.
So, but a dark matter will only mess up the one that goes to the cavity.
That's right.
And your qubits are presumably cheap. So why don't you just put two and mitigate all the backgrounds then?
Yeah, so you use the second one as a check or a way to throw away background. Yeah, that's a great idea. But it essentially comes down to the same thing, right? I make multiple measurements to reject the background where you're using multiple qubits to reject the same background.
No, right? It's not the same. It's not the same because the multiple measurements get rid only, as you explained to me, they cannot get rid of the honest to God photons that come from the backgrounds, right? But the two qubits will get rid of those. Because any
yes, that's correct.
Right? Because any track that passes like and creates, it won't create one photon. Any track that goes through, it won't create one photon. It will just make an S, or it will just, you see, I mean.
Yep, that's a good point. That's right. It will, so only the qubit that's coupled to the cavity will be flipping there.
If a track passes, it's great photons, for instance, and then let's say that's a non-Stugat background event, then it messes up your qubit, for instance. But it will mess up all the other qubits too, because it won't create only one photon, right? It will create many photons.
Yeah, I guess the way to, well.
It will deposit much energy, a lot of energy, right?
That's right, but it'll only mess up the qubit that's outside of the cavity once, just like it'll mess up the measurement qubit once. When there's a real photon that's in the cavity that's deposited by a background event, the measurement qubit will continue to flip back and forth. The other qubit that's outside of the cavity will flip once. You're right, yes. For the same reason.
Yeah.
But how do you discriminate? Well. Okay. Yeah. Maybe then, if that one flips and then you see your photon, you can say, okay, maybe this was a background event.
Right.
That's how you would do it, I think.
Right.
I see. But now, well, then I guess we need to compute the probability that the event, whatever it was, produced a qubit flip and produced a photon, right? But maybe that's close to one. I don't know. But that's a
yeah.
interesting thing to look at. Hmm. Yeah, I agree that you could just have another calibration measurement where you just check to see for backgrounds. I would say maybe your qubit isn't even the best way to check for these backgrounds. Maybe you should just put a TES there or something like that. I think other the group that really worked on this and recently put out a paper where they saw these radiation events affect multiple qubits, I think their next idea is to now integrate a chip with multiple qubits with some TESs so they can reject events that occur like this. So I think that's an idea that people are already thinking about. So it's a, I mean, if you can operate a qubit, you can operate the TES in the same environment too. So I think that'd be pretty cool. Yeah, that's a great idea. One idea that I kind of have been thinking about is, well, like I showed in this plot is, this is a very narrow band search, and that's because our cavity wasn't tunable. But how would you then integrate this qubit sensor with a tunable cavity? The thing to note here is that the qubit and the cavity frequency are already highly detuned. This is something that we had to assume in order to get the interaction that we wanted. And so this is the region in which we need to operate. And so it's not really a big deal if you tune your cavity by a few hundred megahertz this way or that way. The only thing that'll change is the exact energy scale of the interaction between the qubit and the cavity. You can see here these deltas represent the detuning between the qubit and the cavity. So as long as you account for this changing chi as your cavity tunes, you use this chi in your Ramsey interferometry measurement to wait the appropriate amount of time for the qubit to go around the block sphere, you can continue to do your measurement and the Q and D interaction remains unchanged as you tune the cavity. So I think this is a path forward to potentially tuning the cavity and keeping the qubit frequency fixed, which definitely eliminates a lot of complexities. If you had to tune both of them, it'd be really, really challenging, I think. Okay, so now are the wild ideas, I think. So some other ideas that I've thought about for further increasing sort of sensitivity to dark matter right now I've told you about using one qubit to measure the photon many times, but equivalently you could use many qubits to measure the same photon many times as well. And once you do that, then you can start to think about, well, maybe what if I started with all of my qubits entangled together in some sort of W state? And what sort of enhanced metrology could I get from that? And this is already something that people in atomic systems think about, where they entangle all their atoms together before they try to measure a phase, right? And so this is sort of a direct reflection of that sort of technique. And there you can get Heisenberg scaling of your measurement, of your metrology, which will go as n instead of root n, which you would expect. So that'd be pretty interesting to try. And so I've already kind of constructed a device that might be able to do this just for fun and to see if it might work. So these are kind of our future ideas. So mostly what I've discussed in this talk is, how do we beat down the errors or the noise, the backgrounds of our measurement? The other side of the coin is, well, can we figure out a way to boost the potential signal that the dark matter will induce inside of our cavity? And the simplest way to do that is to build a cavity that has a much higher Q than the ones that we're using now. And we have some cool ideas about using novel materials and designs, specifically this photonic structure that's shown here that Ankora works on, to build high Q cavities that are compatible with a magnetic field for an axion search. The other really fun idea I think that we've been playing around with is you can enhance the signal or the probability that a photon will be deposited in the cavity by initializing your cavity in a non-classical state, right? And so we've already been able to show that we can initialize the cavity in a Fock state instead of a coherent state, which is the classical state. So here's a Fock state of 1, here's a Fock state of 8. And the idea here is that the dark matter just looks like a displacement on your cavity. And when you apply this displacement to a Fock state n, the probability that the dark matter will produce a signal has alpha squared in it, which is the amplitude of the displacement, but also has this factor of n, which is related to the Fock state you start off with. So if you can increase the Fock state number, you can potentially increase the probability that there will be a signal in your cavity by a factor of n, which is pretty interesting. Okay, sort of last slide here. I think this has really been a really fun experiment for me to work on, specifically because I've been able to, you know, think about the quantum information techniques and devices, and then take that and apply it to a dark matter cosmology experiment. And the key takeaway, I think, is that we've achieved this 16 dB of metrological gain, and correspondingly that means something like 1,000 times speed up of the dark matter search. And we've also been able to show sort of a sensitivity to a hidden photon dark matter candidate and been able to exclude novel parameter space. And of course, if you have more questions or want to know more about the details, the manuscript is here, and I'm also open to questions now. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Akash. Yeah, we can take more questions.
Can you go back to your sensitivity plot for a second?
Sure.
So shouldn't, so when, now, when you go to very light masses, the coupling should also get suppressed. So the sensitivity should also get suppressed, because your constraint should be worse, because the coupling of the dark photon to the cavity should be compressed by m times r, where r is the size of the cavity.
Okay.
So shouldn't the shape? Can you explain to me the shape?
Yeah. So one thing to notice is that this is very, very zoomed in. This is over.
Yeah.
And this search is all done in the same cavity, right? It's not like I'm changing cavities in each one of these things.
It's
just that the qubit is sensitive to off resonant signals in the cavity. It's just much less sensitive because there's a Lorentzian shape from the cavity line with itself.
Yeah, but there should be, I'm telling you, on top of the Lorentzian, there should be also suppression because of the photon wavelength.
I see. You're saying because the photons here are larger wavelength than the cavity?
Exactly. I think there should be something like that. I mean, it's not a big deal, by the way. It's just that it just occurred to me because it was bugging me a bit.
Yeah, it's like 0.1%, right? Like the range they are doing.
Oh, no, no. In the range and what matter, but it depends on how you... But this is something that... Yeah, it's a very small range, so it won't matter.
I agree. This is what people who work over, you know, in this region think about, right? Like where they're using lumped element LC oscillators that are really, really big compared to the size of the, or they're really, really small compared to the size of the dark matter they're trying to detect. And so then you have this suppression as well. Maybe it's something I should include here. So maybe this line, instead of being the same height, will be slightly lower.
Yeah, that's the only thing. But maybe just, I mean, given that it's a log scale, probably, and one is linear, I think it won't show.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But it would still be fun to include it in the analysis, I think.
I mean, you should include it just to be buyer. You should just include it for future analysis when you start scanning. This is something that you should take into account when you consider the off resonance response.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's just a smaller range. I don't think it will show anything.
Yeah, I doubt it'll be anything on this plot, but it'd be good to have it in the analysis. Yeah.
So the dashed line here in your plot is not... Your limit is just the purple thing, right?
Yeah, the dashed line is just the Lorentzian of the cavity. So I kind of wanted to show where this fits in.
Yeah, but
if that part was flat, then that would be weird.
That would be the modified. So that part should be modified. But it's fine. Look, I mean, it won't show for your actual analysis. It's going
to
be like...
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to show that the purple line also follows the Lorentzian of the cavity here. But you're right that as you get out to here, the purple line will not follow.
Yeah, it won't follow the Lorentzian, basically.
But anyway, we don't have sensitivity there, so.
No, it's fine. It's just something to keep in mind when you do it in the future. Just, I just saw it and it kind of bugged me that it was going flat. It was just, anyway.
Yeah, maybe I could, instead of saying this is the, instead of plotting the Lorentzian, I could plot the Lorentzian suppressed by the factor of the size of the dark matter to the size of the Kappa.
Yeah, because it's just the coupling factor. It's not, it's the, I mean, this is exactly what you're sensitive to, right? It's your, how the Lorentzian times whatever coupling factor that dark matter has to your cavity. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, this is pretty impressive, so just.
I have another question. Like, when you start to like load your cavity with many more photons, of course, like a change of one, like you can read out basically like by like odd and even basic properties.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my question is maybe like related to what like Sergey asked like earlier. Like when you like load many many photons, like do you need to account for the nonlinearities like in your Hamiltonian?
Yeah. So eventually your cavity starts to shift because it's coupled to a qubit and it's also slightly nonlinear, but we can take into account that effect. That's not a big deal. And the other thing you mentioned about odd or even, right? So instead of, so in this particular procedure, I measured odd or even because I was looking for zero or one photons, and that's totally fine. But you're right that if you load n photons, you have to specifically look for, are there n plus one photons, not just odd or even. And the way you do that is you apply a pi pulse that's resolved at this particular peak. So it's instead of using the Ramsey interferometry measurement, you apply a pulse where the qubit is only sensitive if and only if there's n plus one photons. That'll flip the state of the qubit. So there's a way to get around that.
Yeah, how do you do that? Sorry.
So yeah, so you can see that, well, here, let me go back a few slides. So this is a spectra of the qubit itself, right? So if there's zero photons, one or two photons, the transition frequency of the qubit is in a different place. So you can, if you say you want to, you loaded one photon in the cavity and you wanted to check if now the dark matter has induced the cavity to go to two photons. So you can apply a pulse whose bandwidth is smaller than the separation of these two things, such that it flips the qubit if and only if the transition frequency is at this point. And so you end up getting the same effect. The qubit flips if and only if there's n plus one photons, where in this particular experiment, the qubit flips if and only if there's an odd number of photons.
So essentially, like if you go to the next slide,
yeah,
you change this time, tp.
Well, you actually wouldn't even do this type of interferometry okay. measurement. You would just apply a direct excitation to the qubit such that it can only be absorbed if the transition frequency is here.
Yeah, I guess you want to like make sure it's not n minus one because, well, the photon is gone.
Well, the photon could just decay, or your loaded state could just decay to n minus one, right? Yeah. It's much less probable that your loaded state will heat up to n plus one. So you should check it n plus one. It doesn't hurt to check it n minus one, but you should definitely check it n plus one.
Yeah. Almost there. Thanks.
Yeah, the thing that I was saying about coupling the qubit to a tunable cavity where the chi potentially changes as you tune the cavity. In that situation, you're right that you would want to adjust this TP to match the changing chi as your cavity tunes. That's sort of where this comes in, I think. So that just requires you to calibrate what this chi is at each tuning of your cavity, or get sort of a rough idea of what you think it should be as a function of the cavity frequency.
So you're now planning to do axion searches, yeah, with magnetic field, right? Or
probably not me, but that's the idea in the future to integrate this into a axion search, yeah.
And will there? I mean, is it straightforward to include magnetic field, or there will be like problems?
I would say it's not straightforward. So we've sort of worked on this part of the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
If this cavity lives in a magnetic field, I don't think you can put your superconducting qubits inside of this region. And so you need to have some sort of way of getting the signal from here to where you want to detect it. So we've started to think about how we can potentially do that. One idea is to put some sort of nonlinear element here that can be used as a frequency converter. So you can take a photon that's at this frequency and convert it into a photon that's at your storage cavity frequency. Although this becomes really challenging when there's losses along this line, when there's many modes that are along this line. So it's a very careful engineering problem, I think, but not impossible, I think. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's challenging. It's not straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe the most straightforward thing is to figure out a way to build a qubit that can live inside a magnetic field. That probably is even more challenging.
Actually, what are qubits? Realization of qubits apart from the superconducting circles that you have. I mean, what are the other ones?
So I know. You can have atoms. You can use an atom as your qubit. You can use trapped ions. People use like spin defects inside of like NV centers in diamonds. There's lots of other ideas. I'm probably missing a lot of different potential qubits. The really important part about the superconducting qubit is that you can engineer this dipole moment. Mm-hmm. And the dipole moment here is like hundreds of megahertz, whereas for an atom coupled to the same cavity, it's orders of magnitude smaller. So all this nice stuff where you can have these resolvable peaks of the qubit is not possible with a single atom. This is only due to the fact that you can have 100 megahertz G's here between the qubit and the cavity. So if you went to another system that would be compatible to the magnetic field, you have to make sure that you can still have the same type of huge interaction strength between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I know magnons are a possibility. Those are obviously compatible with the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. People have been thinking about magnons as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had one more question. Since you showed it, now you're working with fairly low readout times. What's the advantage of really working with several qubits instead of one qubit reading many times?
Yeah, I think that it's equivalent. The challenge of scaling to many qubits means it's a hardware problem. You have to have many lines. You have to have many generators. So I think you're right that it's probably better just to use one qubit and make sure you get that done really well. I think the advantage might only come if you can entangle all those qubits together, which is something you can't do with a single qubit making multiple measurements. Right? You can't entangle measurements in time, but you can entangle the qubits in space. So that's the only place I think the advantage can come. But I agree, until you figure out a way to do that, you should just make more measurements with the same qubit.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I think there was one more hand up.
Yeah, Carlos. So if Carlos doesn't want to speak up,
that's the question in the
chat. Yeah, can you control the direction of the dipole moment with the superconducting qubits?
Oh yes, absolutely. That's just done by, well, so this structure here sets the dipole moment of the qubit, and you just make sure to align it to be whatever you want relative to the electric field. And you just get the d dot e, and there's obviously a cosine of the relative angle. And so we can design these structures to be whatever we want. You can see that this is actually slightly different than the one I showed here. So here there's a small gap here, and so the dipole moment is essentially along this direction. We currently choose them to be aligned very well with the electric field of the mode of the cavity, but there are other ideas that I've been thinking about where maybe you don't want it to be coupled to a mode, and in which case you would just anti-align it or orthogonally align it with the field of the cavity. Yeah, it's just the direction thing. You just put them across from each other.
Cool. So, yeah, I guess we can thank Akash again. Thank you very much.
Very much.
Very exciting talk.